Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, yeah, it's perfectly equable weather for New Orleans and vicinity right now. You know, it's like wintertime weather. It's in the 60s or something. But Tuesday, it's going to get freezing. What are you people up north sending? What's going on here? I don't understand it. It's supposed to be wintertime. Ladies and gentlemen, some news of the godly to start off the new year. To start it off right. Or left, as the case may be. News of the godly, I'd say. And first, from The Telegraph, the newspaper in London. Because you may be wondering, where are all the young exorcists coming from? I know that question occurs to me almost every century. Dioceses across Italy, as well as in countries such as Spain, or actually Spain, are increasing the number of priests schooled in administering the rite of exorcism. Fabled, says the Telegraph, to rid people of possession by the devil. You've heard of him. Satan. He's been on the show. The rise in demonic cases is the result of more people dabbling in practices such as black magic, paganism, satanic rites, and Ouija boards, often exploring the dark arts with the help of information readily found on the internet, according to the church. The church blames the internet. And vice versa. The increase in the number of priests being trained to tackle the phenomenon is also an effort by the church to sideline unauthorized self-proclaimed exorcists. You know, the black market exorcists, which are such a scourge. And also the tacit recognition by the church that belief in Satan, once regarded by Catholic progressives as an embarrassment, is still very much alive. That's all in Telegraph language. The Diocese of Milan recently nominated 7 new exorcists. The Bishop of Naples appointed 3 new ones a couple of years ago, and the Catholic Church in Sardinia, famed for its, sent 3 priests for exorcism training in Rome amid concern that the Mediterranean island, particularly its mountainous, tradition-bound interior, is a hotbed of occultism. In Spain, Antonio Maria Rouco Varela, the Archbishop of Madrid, chose 8 priests to undergo special training in May, the best month for it, to confront what he described as an unprecedented rise in cases of demonic possession. These are not demonic repossession of houses in Spain. No, not that. The church in Spain was coming across many cases that, quote, go beyond the competence of psychologists, unquote, and they were occurring with, quote, a striking frequency, according to the archbishop. His striking frequency is down markedly this year. Diabolical possessions are on the increase as a result of people subscribing to occultism, says Father Francesco Bamonte, the president of the Italy-based International Association for Exorcists. I'm on their mailing list. They've stopped sending. The few exorcists that we have in the dioceses are often not able to handle the enormous number of requests for help, he told La Repubblica newspaper in Italy last month. The association was founded way back in 1993 by Father Gabriele Amorth, who served as the Vatican's chief exorcist. That worked, and claims to have conducted thousands of exorcisms. That's why things are so good today. He's written several books on the subject. He has claimed that yoga is evil because it leads to a worship of Hinduism and other Eastern religions. So you know he's got to be good. During the papacy of Benedict, he said that the sex abuse scandals which engulfed the church in the U.S., Ireland, Australia, and other countries were proof that the Antichrist was waging a war against the Vatican. The need for exorcisms is very, very rare, says Father Vincenzo Taraborelli, a priest in a church which is just a few hundred yards from the Vatican. Don Gianni Sini, a priest in Sardinia, says, people come to me thinking that with exorcism they can resolve all the problems they have in their lives. A child is doing badly at school. With an exorcism, we can make him study. Out of 100 people that I receive, there will be one who has need of me as an exorcist, unquote. See, an ethical exorcist is what you have to take your hat off to. The Catholic rite of exorcism involves a consecrated priest invoking the name of God as well as various saints and the archangel Michael to cast out their demons. The growth in the number of priests being trained is in response to public demand, but it's also about quality control, says John Allen, an expert on the Vatican from the National Catholic Reporter. Public demand and quality control. Hey, it sounds just like Microsoft. Meanwhile, also in news from the godly, a former Tulia, this would be Texas, Tulia, Texas priest has been sentenced to 10 years in prison after pleading guilty to molesting a young male parishioner who attended the Church of the Holy Spirit. John Salazar pleaded guilty to a second-degree felony charge of indecency with a child, $1,500 fine. In Los Angeles, Salazar had pleaded guilty in 1987 to one count of oral sex and one count of lewd or lascivious acts with a child for molesting two altar boys ages 13 to 14. Salazar, who was required to register as a sex offender and was banned from serving as a priest in the Los Angeles diocese, served 3 years of a prison term before being sent in 1990 to a New Mexico treatment program for pedophile priests. And then the Amarillo diocese hired Salazar and assigned him, while he was still on parole, to the Church of the Holy Spirit. Diocesan officials said later they had received no complaints during his service with the tiny parish. In a letter to a Los Angeles cardinal in 1992, former Amarillo Bishop Leroy Matheson defended his decision to hire priests with backgrounds of sexual abuse. He died in 2010, but in his autobiography, he said the priests he hired had repented, paid the price, were rehabilitated, stayed within the boundaries laid out for them. The Diocese of Amarillo has since issued a statement by the new bishop saying a serious mistake was made when Salazar was brought to Tulia. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. You know, the name of the Iraqi town, Fallujah, is back in American news, at least some of it, after a long absence, because Al-Qaeda has taken it over. Yes, this was the town that the Marines spent a lot of time and did a lot of killing. The physical results of that action are still being felt in Fallujah. I've shared with you on this program before the rather remarkable upsurge in certain physical ailments and disabilities that have occurred since the action in Fallujah, presumably, reputedly, not proven, to be associated with the use of depleted uranium by the Marines while they were there. But there was a surge, and we got Fallujah back. And that's pointed to as, you know, that was part of the Sunni awakening, where the Sunnis awakened and turned against Al-Qaeda. Well, now, it's reported this week, Al-Qaeda is back in Fallujah, has taken control. Also, Ramadi, nearing taking control of Ramadi, if they haven't already, another town in the same Sunni-dominated part of Iraq. So I guess we would call this the Sunni asleepening. Hello, welcome to the show.
Wake up, please, Susie. Wake up, please, Susie.
from the shores of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, where, yeah, the temporary pumps are still hanging in there, kinda, maybe, sorta. Who knows? I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
It's so listenable. A new study quantifies for the first time future losses in deep-sea marine life using advanced climate models. I love seeing the advanced climate models walk the catwalk, or is it the cakewalk? Results show that even the most remote deep-sea ecosystems are not safe from the impact of climate change. An international team of scientists predict seafloor-dwelling marine life, and they have it good, don't they, will decline by up to 38% in the North Atlantic and over 5% globally over the next century. These changes will be driven by a reduction in the plants and animals that live at the surface of the oceans, and when they die, feed deep-sea communities. As a result, ecosystem services such as fishing will be threatened. In the study led by the National Oceanography Center, an actual center, the team used the latest suite of climate models to predict changes in food supply throughout the world oceans. They then applied a relationship between food supply and biomass calculated from a huge global database of marine life. The results of the study are published this week in the scientific journal Global Change Biology. That database is also being used, of course, in Ocean Bottom Mingle, the dating site for. These changes in seafloor communities are expected despite living on average 4 kilometers under the surface of the ocean. This is because their food source, the remains of surface ocean marine life that sink to the floor, will dwindle because of a decline in nutrient availability. Nutrient supplies, in turn, will suffer because of climate impacts such as slowing of the global ocean circulation, as well as increased separation between water masses, known as stratification, as a result of warmer and rainier weather. Lead author Daniel Jones says there's been some speculation about climate change impacts on the seafloor, but we wanted to try and make numerical projections for these changes and estimate specifically where they would occur. We were, he says, expecting some negative changes around the world, but the extent of changes, particularly in the North Atlantic, were staggering. Globally, we are talking about losses of marine life weighing more than every person on the planet put together. I know some people you better include in that. Cold-sensitive mangrove forests have expanded dramatically along Florida's Atlantic coast as the frequency of killing frosts has declined, according to a new study based on 28 years of satellite data from the University of Maryland and the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. Between 1984 and 2011, the Florida Atlantic coast, from Miami northward, gained more than 3,000 acres of mangroves. All the increases occurred north of Palm Beach County. So Rush Limbaugh isn't seeing any more mangroves. Between Cape Canaveral, National Seashore, and St. Augustine, mangroves doubled in area. Meanwhile, between the study's first 5 years and its last 5 years, nearby Daytona Beach recorded almost a day and a half fewer per year when temperatures fell below 28 degrees Fahrenheit. The number of killing frosts in southern Florida was unchanged. The mangroves march up the coast as far as St. Augustine is a striking example of one way climate change's impacts show up in nature, according to Science Daily. Rising temperatures lead to new patterns of extreme weather, which in turn causes major changes in plant communities, according to these studies' authors. You might think that's good news if you like mangroves, but temperature rises resulting from unchecked climate change will be at the severe end of those projected, according to a new scientific study reported by the Guardian newspaper in London. The scientists leading the research said that unless emissions of greenhouse gases were cut, the planet would heat up by a minimum of 4 degrees centigrade, minimum of 4 degrees centigrade by 2100, twice the level the world's governments deem dangerous. The research indicates that fewer clouds form as the planet warms, meaning less sunlight is reflected back into space, driving temperatures up further still, a neat little feedback thing. The way clouds affect global warming has been the biggest mystery surrounding future climate change. Professor Stephen Sherwood, University of New South Wales in Australia, who led the new work, said this study breaks new ground twice, first by identifying what is controlling the cloud changes, and second by strongly discounting the lowest estimates of future global warming in favor of the higher and more damaging estimates. 4 degrees centigrade would likely be catastrophic rather than simply dangerous, he said. For example, it would make life difficult, if not impossible, in much of the tropics, and would guarantee the eventual melting of the Greenland ice sheet and some of the Antarctic ice sheet, with sea levels rising by many meters as a result. The research is a big advance that halves the uncertainty about how much warming is caused by rises in carbon emissions, according to scientists commenting on the study. Two scientists at Japan's National Institute for Environmental Studies said the explanation of how fewer clouds form as the world warms is convincing, and agreed this indicated future climate would be changed more greatly than expected. But they said more challenges lay ahead to narrow down further the projections of further temperatures. And not in the world of projection, in the world of reality. Hey, some reality-based information for you. Australia smashed its previous annual heat record in 2013. With a summer heat wave and spring hot spell among the outstanding periods of unusual warmth, the Bureau of Meteorology confirmed that last year was the hottest in Australia in more than a century of standardized records, with mean temperatures 1.2 degrees above the 1961 to 1990 average. The 12 months easily eclipsed the previous annual record set in 2005, when mean temperatures were 1.03 degrees above average. Every state and the Northern Territory. How many states does Australia have? Hands? Thank you. Recorded at least their fourth warmest year by mean temperatures, underscoring the breadth of 2013's unusual heat. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, but now some good news. News of Nice Corporation. Nice people doing nice things. It appears to be sell-off time at Nice Corp. Roop is shedding some assets, you know, because that's what you do when you have assets, I guess. I hear. So let's review what Roop is letting go of. 20th Century Fox says Thursday it was selling its 47% stake in Star China TV, which operates three Mandarin-language television stations. Terms were not disclosed. You may recall the Star Satellite Network was Rupert's first advance into China, and it was in that business that he met and eventually married his now ex-wife. So selling off China assets makes possibly some sense in that context. Founded in 2010 and majority owned by the Chinese company that's now buying the rest of it, Star China TV operates three 24-hour channels, Xing Kong International, and Channel V Mainland China. James Murdoch, Rupert's son and chairman and chief executive of international operations at 21st Century Fox, well, that's where they shoved him, said the divestiture is part of, quote, streamlining our affiliate ownership structures, unquote. He did not issue a similar statement explaining the fact that Rupert has sold off his yacht as well. I guess, you know, when you're being nice, you don't really need to worry about a yacht. Nice people doing nice things.
Of course one enjoys the feeling of power.
Of course. Of course one does. Bad banks, ladies and gentlemen. I asked last week for some idea of how much in fines our major banks have paid in the wake of the financial starting in 2008. It still continues. And we just reports trickle in. Reuters this week reported Citigroup has paid $250 million, that's a quarter of a billion, for those of you keeping track, to Fannie and Freddie, the taxpayer-owned mortgage buyers, to settle a lawsuit over soured mortgage securities. That's according to the regulator of the two housing finance firms. General Electric Company, which basically makes a lot of its money, if not most of its money, from its finance arm, also paid $25 million to settle a similar suit. Both Citi and GE had previously settled the claims last year, but neither had disclosed the terms. So add that. Anybody keeping track, add those to your totals as the fines for the bad banks continue to mount. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, need it be added, nobody's going to jail. Because, you know, they're bankers. And now,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this one, this will titillate your Sunday. A special agent with the Drug Enforcement, this could be called, this is your anti-drug policy on sex. This is the brains of your anti-drug policy on sex. A special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration attempted to solicit sex as many as 50 times using a government-issued cell phone. Another sent text messages to a transvestite prostitute he found on a website. And a third had a very curious definition of the word sex. These are some of the eye-popping details found in a previously unreleased report from the Justice Department Inspector General, obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by Foreign Policy magazine. It shows that three DEA special agents in Colombia solicited sex from prostitutes on numerous occasions, arranged for encounters using their government-issued cell phones, and brought women back to their government-furnished apartments, putting themselves at risk for blackmail or coercion or venereal disease, and jeopardizing national security information. The men were implicated by their cell phone call histories and contacts, which showed numerous communications with prostitutes. And when the agents were confronted with the evidence, they tried to conceal the extent of their activities. Two agents went so far as to erase numbers and other data in their cell phones before handing them over to investigators. These are law enforcement officials, ladies and gentlemen, of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Maybe Colorado does have the right idea. The incident stems from a raucous night in Cartagena, Colombia way in April 2012, when nine Secret Service agents providing security for President Obama's visit during the Summit of the Americas were found to have paid for or solicited prostitutes. Two of the DEA agents arranged for a supervisor in the Secret Service's Intelligence Division, which investigates threats against the president, to receive an erotic message, which included oral sex from a prostitute in one of the DEA agents' apartment. The Secret Service prostitution scandal made national headlines, but less has been reported about the DEA agents and their extensive history of solicitation in Colombia, where prostitutes are known to be used as spies by drug cartels. These details are contained in the IG report. Investigators were tipped to the DEA agents' behavior when the Secret Service supervisor stepped forward and admitted he'd been with a woman who was paid for an erotic massage. In interviews with the Justice Department's Inspector General's office, the agents whose names are redacted in the report initially denied any knowledge of the DEA personnel, but then investigators combed through the agents' government-issued cell phones. One agent had attempted to solicit sex as many as 50 times. Another had contacted a prostitute he found on a website who advertised herself as a chica trans con apartamento privado, or a transvestite girl with a private apartment. The agent said he had exchanged text messages with the prostitute and negotiated to pay 200,000 Colombian pesos for an encounter while he was on assignment in Medellin. But the two ended up not meeting. The agent admitted to deleting 37 contacts from his cell phone after he was told to surrender it to investigators. Some of those contacts were later linked to prostitutes or sex websites. After they'd been caught, the agents tried to argue that they hadn't engaged in prostitution because their relations with women consisted only of massages and, quote, manual stimulation of their genitals by another person for their sexual gratification, unquote, which they said didn't qualify as sex. How Clintonian. What's more, quote, all three subjects resisted the characterization of their engaging in sexual encounters in exchange for a form of payment as prostitution, unquote. The DEA. I guess they're trained as lawyers. And Deficient computer security at the Federal Election Commission has already led to high-level breaches, and it puts the agency at high risk of continued hacking, according to a Federal Inspector General report. The Federal Election Commission information systems, which tracked more than $6 billion in political spending last cycle, quote, have serious internal control vulnerabilities and have been penetrated at the highest levels of the agency, according to the FEC Inspector General. The report, which reiterates security concerns flagged by federal auditors for several years running, identifies two specific high-level hacking incidents in May of last year. An adversary identified as an advanced persistent threat compromised a commissioner's personal user account as well as several FEC systems for 8 consecutive months. During that period, the unidentified hacker had potential access to such sensitive information as details of Election Commission investigations, briefs, subpoenas, and personal identifying information. The second intrusion took place last August and involved the public disclosure website of the agency, forcing the agency to shut down portions of the system while it investigated. And while it was working on remediating that breach, another intrusion was detected on the agency's website in early fiscal year 2014. The report gives no further details of the second intrusion, but a recent investigation by the Center for Public Integrity disclosed that Chinese hackers crashed Federal Election Commission computer systems just after the government shutdown, a breach that the Center for Public Integrity identified as possibly the worst act of sabotage in the Election Commission's 38-year history. But, you know, they're just looking after our elections, ladies and gentlemen. No big deal. News of the Inspectors General. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
I'll never let you see the way my broken heart is hurting me. I've got my pride and I know how to hide all my sorrow and pain. I'll do my crying in the rain. If I wait for cloudy skies, you won't know the rain from the tears in my eyes. You'll never know that I still love you so, though the heartaches remain. I'll do my crying in the rain. Raindrops falling from heaven could never wash away my misery. But since we're not together, I look for stormy weather. Someday when my crying's done, I'm gonna wear a smile and walk in the sun. I may be a fool, but till then, darling, you'll never see me complain. I'll do my crying in the rain. I'll do my crying in the rain. I'll do my crying.
From New Orleans, this is Le Show. Ladies and gentlemen, just backtracking a moment to what I was speaking about early in the broadcast, the idea of the Sunnis in Fallujah no longer necessarily resisting or attacking, fighting against the Iraqi affiliate of Al-Qaeda. And just a question. When the surge happened, which was credited with energizing the so-called Sunni awakening, what was not widely reported was that Sunni tribal leaders, under the direction of General Dave Petraeus — hey, Dave, how's the academic life working out for you? — Dave Petraeus, were being paid off money, funds were exchanging hands that absolutely coincidentally occurred at the same time that they were changing sides from being allied with al-Qaeda in Iraq to opposing al-Qaeda in Iraq. So would it be possible that the change in fortunes in Fallujah would be not only simultaneous, but causally related to the fact that we're not paying off the Sunni tribal leaders anymore? Just asking. Now news of Apple. Opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan has surged to record heights during 2013, increasing for the third straight year, or as the publication I have in my hand says, for the third straight year in a row, and confirming the country's status as the world's number one exporter of the opium crop. That's right, Afghanistan is number one. According to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime's annual opium survey, two factors were behind the rise in cultivation: high opium prices and speculation due to the withdrawal of U.S. and international troops from Afghanistan. Cultivation of the crop spread to two previously poppy-free provinces. In an interview with Stars and Stripes, Yuri Fedotov, head of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, said the ability of international organizations to continue working in Afghanistan and combating the trade would partly depend on the size of the international presence after 2014. What does that tell you? Whether U.S. and NATO forces remain depends on whether Afghan President Hamid Karzai signs a bilateral security pact. The United States was demanding he do so by December 31st of last year. What does that tell you? Eradication efforts throughout Afghanistan declined in 2013, a decline of 24% of acres eradicated from 2012. The major uptick in poppy cultivation this year has been an unwelcome reminder of the uncertain allegiances after U.S. troops leave the country, according to Stars and Stripes. While the U.N. says it has programs in place that are meant to give Afghan farmers an alternative crop choice, those programs have been largely unsuccessful. It is hard for them to sell their products, Fedotov said. Well, they don't have such a problem when they're growing opium poppy. Seems to be demand. Seems to be a demand issue. Dateline Kabul, also from Stars and Stripes, the war is far from over for Afghan civilians. In its mid-year report, the United Nations Mission for Afghanistan said 1,300 civilians were killed between January and June of last year, 14% more than the same period a year earlier. Of civilians killed in the first half, 231 were children, most of whom were killed by improvised explosive devices. The UN blamed insurgents for nearly three-fourths of the civilian deaths. Kate Clark, a senior analyst with the Afghanistan Analyst Network, if you need an analyst, who do you call, said the war for Afghans looks completely different than it did a year ago. I think the nature of the war is changing, she said. It's predominantly Afghan versus Afghan now. You're welcome. She says it's impossible to say how the situation will evolve over the next year. At the moment, they're saying it's a jihad against foreign occupation. She said the fewer actual foreigners there are on the ground, the less they can make that argument, she says, referring to the Taliban. She pointed out during the Civil War in the 1990s, each side claimed it was fighting a war against foreigners, even though all the fighters were Afghan. But they did all receive material support from foreign powers. We call that a proxy war, babe. Check it out. And Dateline Kabul. American senators visiting the Afghan capital this week intensified pressure on President Karzai to sign that long-term security deal. And responding to a new crisis between the allies this week, they warned the Afghan government away from plans to summarily release dozens of detainees who were accused of attacking American forces. If these releases go ahead, it will do irreparable damage to the relationship, says Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina. There will be a backlash, he threatens, in the U.S. Congress, I guess against continued aid. Graham and John McCain, a fellow Republican, have been frequent visitors to Afghanistan, and they're still among the most ardent congressional supporters of continued American role. But they told reporters they had expressed grave concerns to Karzai over a lunch meeting, warning that American will to stay involved with Afghanistan was dwindling and that the planned prisoner release is adding further strain. American officials want the prisoners to be prosecuted, saying the men are members of the Taliban or allied militant groups that are suspected of the deaths of 117. And they got a specific number. What's your problem with that? 117 members of the Afghan or International Security Forces. The men are being held at Bagram Air Base. It was the main American prison in Afghanistan. It was kind of like the other Guantanamo, although it didn't get anywhere near the amount of publicity. But a lot of similar stuff went on there. It was transferred to the Afghan government by us, the United States, last year. That transfer of authority over detainees seemed to have settled a corrosive dispute between Karzai and his American supporters and clearing the way for the talks on the bilateral agreement. But the troop deal is now in limbo. A long succession of American officials have warned him the delay could scuttle the entire deal. Karzai then began issuing new demands, as you know, alienating some of his own Afghan supporters and infuriating American officials. Now the flare-up over the prisoners. Lindsey Graham said it would be devastating any future negotiations with the United States if Karzai releases the prisoners. The releases were ordered by a commission Karzai appointed to review the cases of those detained at Bagram. American officials say freeing the men would violate the prison deal struck last March when they turned over the prison. If this agreement is dishonored, how can you expect future agreements to be honored, Graham asked. I guess he didn't ask about the dishonoring of the Convention Against Torture by the current and previous administrations. Guess he didn't do that. Figuring out where Karzai stands has proved more difficult, says the New York Times. His office issued an ambiguous statement after his lunch with the American senators. Quote, Afghanistan wants the innocent prisoners to be released and criminals must be punished, it said, unquote. The Afghan commission reviewing the cases has said the prisoners are innocent or that there is not enough evidence to justify holding them until trial. The men are among the 650 detainees the commission has ordered freed since beginning its work last year. The remaining ones could begin being freed as early as Saturday, i.e. yesterday. The commission also ordered 100-plus detainees to stand trial. Karzai's office suggested the Americans were being hypocritical on the issue of detainees. It was at the behest of American officials that a system of imprisoning battlefield detainees without trial was established in Afghanistan over the criticism of many Afghan and international officials. Now, Karzai's office said, the Americans are holding themselves up as protectors of Afghan justice. How dare he? How dare he? Let's see how dare he.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, like us on Facebook. Or else.
From the newly fumigated presidential palace in downtown Kabul, as if there's an uptown Kabul. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Tick and Talk, the Play for Time brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the charity that distributes books, except medical books, worldwide. BordersWithoutDoctors.com.
I like the medical books. The pictures help my children stay frightened.
Pictures of you would do that.
But enough about my parenting strategies. Mm-hmm. You've had a big week. Once again, my younger brother.
Yes.
You stood tall against the foreign invaders whose financial support keeps us from eating tumbleweeds for breakfast.
Mahmoud. We don't have tumbleweeds in our fair nation.
Of course not. We ate them all before the Americans came.
Sounds like you've sold some Toyotas to some generals this week.
When you deal with Mahmoud, the Toyota time never ends.
One more free plug and we'll have to start charging you as an underwriter.
If I don't move these vehicles before inventory tax day, forget underwriter. I'll be underwater.
You will, yes. But okay, do me a favor.
Anything within reason.
The waving inflatable man in front of your dealership?
Yes.
Take my face off him. Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, this is John, a longtime visitor, first-time caller.
Senator McCain, thank you for taking time out from your important work of being on American talk shows to join ours.
Oh, I didn't take time out. Meet the press is waiting for me.
As well they should.
Your friend, Senator Graham, was making some mighty threatening noises this week.
Oh, that was just because I had the heat up in our room too high. He likes it cold, and
No, sir, I mean public noises.
Oh, sure.
Wait a minute. Senator, mm-hmm. You share rooms here in Kabul?
It's just our way of saving the taxpayers some money on our overseas junkets. Mm. Also, he's got the channels on the remote totally scouted before I've even figured out where the on switch is.
Usually the same place as the off switch.
Yeah, that's a good tip. Now, listen, fellas, Senator Graham is a good friend. In fact, he's a good friend of mine. But he comes from a state with a long history of what you might call somewhat hot-headed politicians, mm-hmm. whereas the legacy of my state is one of, you might say, flinty conservatives. So I'm not yet prepared to make the kind of noises he did.
About the room temperature?
About your deal with our country. Mm.
So do you have a question? If we don't answer questions, we lose a couple of foundation grants for the show.
Question is, what's holding the damn deal up? Let's sign the damn deal.
Mr. Senator, mm-hmm. as I understand it, what's holding the deal up is your country's refusal to accede to my brother's unpredictable cascade of unacceptable demands. How do you explain that?
Mr. Senator, yes. My brother is as bad at explaining national policy as he is at fulfilling the commitments of the warranties of the vehicles he sells.
Fellas, this is all even more entertaining than Celine Dion's late show in Las Vegas, which I've heard is pretty blue. Ooh. But
sir, how did all these detainees get into your prison to begin with?
Well, given that the worst of the worst went to Guantanamo, these guys must have been the second worst of the worst.
Or the worst of the second worst.
But we have information they were turned in by forces which were trying to get the bounty payments from your country. Aren't we really just cleaning up your human rights mess?
Oh. Hamid, my friend, these people will say anything to get out from 12 years of harsh detention without trial. But we're in a long twilight struggle against the forces of darkness, and sometimes it really does take 1,000 detainees to screw in one light bulb.
Well, after we free them, maybe we should send them to Poland.
Thanks for the call. You know, my older brother, and I hate to say it, but I think our friend John is trapped in the past.
Ooh. How do you mean, my younger brother?
Well, I think the detainee to light bulb ratio he was thinking about was based on incandescent bulbs.
Hello, you are on Cars I Talk.
Hello, this is Omar, long-time puppy wholesaler, first-time caller.
Omar, my man, I imagine you're doing better business right now than a bong store in Denver.
Well, I can't complain, but I do have a question.
Ah, that's good news. At least somebody fits into the format.
What's your question, Omar?
Well, don't get me wrong. Mm. I appreciate the fact that the infidels' puppy eradication programs have been shut down.
Well, it was our pleasure.
Actually, it was his pleasure. It was my business. No.
But I'm just curious, doesn't the significant increase in the supply of puppy just push down the prices that people like me can get from my retail accounts? Shouldn't I, as a businessman, vote against your allies in the upcoming election?
Omar, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Would you rather be haggling with a corner shop owner over the price you get for your puppy, or would you rather be dodging bullets from a drone programmed to use infrared sensors to spot concentrations of opium?
They have those.
Lindsey Graham told me they do.
Well, I ran an Afghan restaurant in Washington in 1998, and Lindsey Graham assured me that Bill Clinton would be impeached and convicted.
And you came home when you realized that I had brought stability to your homeland?
I came home when the Americans killed my brother and somebody had to take over the family business. The puppies don't sell themselves.
You know, I agree with my brother on this, caller. Lower prices mean you just have to expand your market, get more people to sample your product. I, for example, have never indulged yet.
Are you going to be there half an hour after the show ends?
No, he has to stick around. He's also the network's ombudsman. Thanks for the call.
We had help today from the NSA Foundation, helping to provide the back doors to the world.
Legal services of Karzai Talk from the law firm of Ketchum and Newcomb. I'm Hamid.
And I am Mahmoud. Join us again for another edition of Karzai Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Store candles and fight a bath up in Mabel's room. When you were down, she could make you laugh up in Mabel's room. Orange crate tables, cigarettes without labels, on a blanket woven on an Indian loom. And I'm a man, strong and stable, who should wear the label.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the Guardian newspaper in London, good news for everybody here in South Louisiana who's so happy with folks at BP, British Petroleum. British Petroleum. BP has won permission to drill in the waters off Greenland, just 3.5 years after abandoning similar plans to apply for a license up there in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon thing. Greenpeace says it beggared belief that a company with BP's checkered track record, would be allowed to work in one of the world's most fragile environments. The British oil company confirmed it had won a license to work on the Amarok concession off the coast of northeast Greenland, its first permit in and around that country. The government boasted that the presence of big oil companies would accelerate the chances of striking oil, but even some energy executives have warned of a potential disaster because of the difficulties of dealing with a spill around ice. BP and our partners are pleased to have been awarded Block 8 in the northeast Greenland license round. Northeast Greenland is a long-term play, and we expect several years of careful planning before exploring this challenging and interesting region. Nice, unquote. Nice use of words. It's a play, but it's challenging. A challenging play. BP applied for the license as operator, but it subsequently decided to hand that role over to the government operator ENI in an unusual move that would only say was mutually agreed between the consortium partners and the government. The Minister for Industry and Mineral Resources of Greenland insisted that safety would be paramount. Or Sony. All exploration for oil and gas is conducted by following the highest achievable standards. Achievable. When it comes to protecting the marine environment and living resources in the sea, said the minister. You do know BP's safety record includes not only the thing in the Gulf, but a refinery explosion in Texas some years earlier, which killed a number of workers in the area. The French oil group Total has argued that energy companies should stay away from the Arctic because an oil spill would risk doing so much damage to the environment. Christophe de Margerie, the group's chief executive, told the Financial Times in September 2012, quote, oil on Greenland would be a disaster, unquote. Enter BP on cue. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Congratulations, guys. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast, as is the apologies of the week, as are the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, former militants from the Basque separatist group ETA have expressed regret for carrying out acts of violence in the past. The group of about 70 recently released prisoners said they were aware of the suffering and damage they had caused. The statement was read out at a meeting in the Basque Spanish town of Durango. The government has condemned the event, describing it as a witch's Sabbath. The statement issued by the former prisoners said they, quote, accepted full responsibility for the consequences of the conflict. This is why we will act responsibly with positive and constructive will and vision, statement, and demanded an amnesty for remaining detainees of the group. BBC says it will be interpreted by some as a guarded apology. I don't know anybody who was hired to be an apology guard, but we'll look into that. Dateline Lansing, Michigan, the general manager of the municipal power company serving Michigan's capital city, has apologized for leaving the state on vacation shortly after an ice storm knocked out power to 40% of its customers. Timing, babe, timing. Lansing Board of Water and Light's J. Peter Lark called the New York City trip a mistake. Or J. Peter Mistake called it a lark. He spoke Thursday at a news conference saying the trip caused an appearance problem. He rejected calls for him to resign. It wasn't the best decision at the time, said Lark. The owner of a Kansas City nightclub has apologized for social media advertising on New Year's Eve that made a reference to rape. The postings on Facebook and Twitter brought a barrage of criticism. Stuart Salomon, owner of the Aura nightclub, said a staff member initially posted the horribly worded message on the bar's Facebook page. When I saw the post, I immediately removed it. I'm very sorry for any offense it caused and take full responsibility for any action of my staff, Salomon said. The post said Aura was introducing, quote, the anti-rape program. We won't rape you on prices on New Year's Eve, unquote. The staff person's intent was not to offend, but it was a poor choice of words, Salomon said. I've spoken extensively to the person who wrote this, and they're obviously feeling awful about it. The person responsible for the message will not be posting on the Facebook page anymore. Ooh, what a dire punishment that is. Banned from the bar's Facebook page. Ooh. Maruha Nichira Holdings Incorporated has apologized for grossly understating the potential health effects caused by consuming frozen food products tainted with a pesticide. The erroneous statement came on December 29th when Maruha Nichiro announced that frozen food, including corn croquettes, produced at its plant in Uizumi in Japan, this is Japanese food, contained the pesticide malathion. Company officials said at the time a 20-kilogram child would have to eat 60 corn croquettes to cause any ill effects. The company, Japan's largest seafood processing company, retracted the statement. Officials at the news conference said a 20-kilogram child would have to eat just 1/8 of a croquette with the malathion concentration for such symptoms to occur. Company officials said health ministry officials pointed out the mistake. It was a major error, and I would like to deeply apologize to the president of the company. In an extraordinary interview, Florida's former Republican Governor Charlie Crist apologized for having supported efforts to ban same-sex marriage on the ballot in 2008. "I'm sorry I did that. It was a mistake. I was wrong. Please forgive," said Crist in an interview with an LGBT news organization in Florida. He's now a Democrat, running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Timing? And Chinese branches of Walmart have been forced to recall batches of donkey meat after it was found to contain fox. The U.S. company has apologized and said it would reimburse China shoppers who bought the five-spice donkey product, which tests showed contained the DNA of other animals. And Melissa Harris Perry, a New Orleanian who hosts a show on MSNBC, has apologized for leading a New Year's Eve kind of year-end roundup of comedians that jocularly had fun at the expense of the black grandchild of Mitt Romney, depicted in a family photo of the Romneys around Christmas time. She, in expressing the apology yesterday on the MSNBC broadcast, was tearful. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the Mighty 104 in England, via Stitcher.com. It'll be on your smartphone, or heard around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at kcsn.org and harryshearer.com, and available as a free podcast through wwno.org, soundcloud.com, and iTunes. And it would be just like hearing some shows of the week next week if you'd agree to join with me then. Will you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show up, pound to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile in Hawaii desk. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. I'll see you on Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. And everything on the website, at the store at harryshearer.com, still just $5. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. Happy New Year, everybody.